not easy to understand.
Well, I don't understand it. I don't see the correlation at all. If you start crossing that line, I don't see that there's any end to the kinds of correlations you can draw between activities people engage in and whether or not they're likely or to have a propensity to use or abuse firearms. To me, this is a big line that we've crossed with this kind of language, and I don't really understand it. I have yet to hear a decent explanation from any of you as to why this is necessary.
You're talking about lines 8 to 10, or are you talking also on
the 8 to 10 doesn't bother me as much as the 2021 and to some extent the 16 through 19. That okay. All that language is, I mean, it certainly could work theoretically in a good way, but I can think of hundreds if not thousands of people that would be excluded from purchasing firearms by virtue of these kinds of offenses. And not all of them are necessarily going to be criminals the rest of their life and may not use them at all. I happen to know of a couple of attorneys that would not qualify to own a firearm because of, I'm not one of them, but lines 20 and 21. And I doubt they'd be real thrilled to find that out.
This is not a permanent prohibition.
They're going to say 4 years.
Or you can appeal it, too. There is an appeal process.
Okay, why don't we get on? Well, somebody else wanted to make a statement, please.
Behind this, there's in violence that we face as police officers, quite often alcohol is involved. And weapons and alcohol are involved. And the discussion that went around this was to define a way to prohibit those that are violence prone to use alcohol and or may use alcohol to exempt from purchasing and or possessing firearms. Now, it was understood in the discussion that there was an obvious option and availability for those folks to appeal that process and right to access purchase and possession. So that was included in that difficult for us as well. Definition.
Senator Brennan.
Using that logic, the next step I'd say would be to take their kids away from them.
Senator Shoemaker.
Why would you not simply list the specific crimes that you thought would render a person unsafe to own firearms rather than trying to get at it through a generic? Did you consider doing that?
Yes.
I'd like to hear from the principals. Yeah, go ahead, please. Hey, whoever would.
Senator Shoemaker, we did.
Sorry?
We did discuss that. The main reason we didn't choose that avenue was because crimes can change and different definitions can change. And
but,
we thought it would
be. If you don't have a definition, that helps you out pretty clearly.
Wait a minute. Now, you're saying that you didn't do that because in the future we might change some of those crimes, and then this would make this statute then out of step?
Correct.
That doesn't get in the way of doing it in other statutes throughout our books. You're constantly referring to other statutes that, of course, they may change from time to time, and that's part of what legislative counsel's for, is to keep track of those things.
We felt a better approach was to go after the problem was to define the problem we were trying to get at.
Is it because that you were trying to put it in a way that would allow you to pick up everybody who might be prone to the misuse of firearms and catch them all in the net because of a propensity to use alcohol or any controlled substance?
And people who act irresponsibly.
Then let out of the net those that you felt were safe after a hearing? Is that regardless whether the original catch would include a preponderance of people who shouldn't have firearms?
Is that what this is supposed to do?
Mr. Chair, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, that may not have been the beginning intent of the working group. Certainly, I think that was the intent of the committee when the House Judiciary Committee passed the bill out.
That present constitutional problems? Sort of categorizing people because of some characteristic of their personality that in some of those people leads them into destructive behavior, and so you're saying that for all of those people, we will presume that to start off that they shouldn't have firearms, and then we will have a screening process. I guess I need some constitutional advice on this, but that sort of strikes me as questionable.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, that was discussed on the House side. There has to be an underlying criminal conviction, and because the bill was drafted in such a way so that it was you were going to have a that you needed to have a conviction involving drugs or alcohol before it would trigger the provisions, the consensus of the committee after looking at that issue decided that there was not a problem.
Okay, but you don't have to have a conviction if you've got an outstanding warrant.
That's a separate issue, and the issues of the constitutionality of 8, 9, and 10, I think, are a separate issue and ones that were raised late in the game and I think are worthy of some further discussion.
Okay. Okay.
I think in terms of dealing with the drug and alcohol...
Turning to the other, though, because some of the offenses that that put you within the net, to pursue my metaphor, are those which really don't make the person a danger in terms of possessing the firearms, like... one less than an ounce of marijuana, and that's simply not relevant to whether or not you're safe or not safe to have firearms. No connection.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, there are a lot of felony offenses which by state and federal law prohibit you from owning firearms that do not have a correlation either. And so that decision has already been made.
Felonies, yeah. And I guess there's been a societal decision regarding felonies somewhere in the past that if you commit a felony and you're convicted of a felony, you do forfeit certain of your rights. Now we're moving it down not only to misdemeanors but to offenses without any established relevancy between the particular offense and the prohibition that's contained within the statute.
Just to clarify something, I don't think it was the committee's intent to move it as far down as offenses. And I mean, that has to be raised. Part of my job today is to raise that issue and bring that to you because it that was a last-minute oversight, and it was certainly not the intent of the House committee or the House, I think, to bring it that far down.
Okay, just so we're straight on that, you're saying it's not their intent to bring it as far down as violations because offense is the generic term that covers felonies, misdemeanors, and violations.
You recognize
that. I'm sorry.
Any other comments?
I got the process.
You're going to screen out violations. What you're doing?
Pardon?
You want to screen out violations.
Okay. Corey, go ahead then. Senator Hill, do you have a question?
Madam Chair, I guess we'll get to it, but counsel
we get to possession.
To possession. So we can just go ahead and we'll get to that section.
Section 4 deals with...
Jack has another question.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize we were almost done. Could you tell me what a temporary transfer means in line 27? What the definition of temporary is? Is there one in the bill someplace?
I don't believe there's a definition of temporary transfer in the bill, but that to me that means that if you're going to give your child or someone else a rifle to go hunting, it's in your possession. This does not prohibit that. Is what this language is meant to mean.
So the way. I guess you're basing your opinion on previous discussions in committee. So temporary would include a one-day hunting trip. How about, for instance, if a child enrolls in a hunter safety course that lasts a year, would temporary cover that?
For the period of time that the person was in the class.
So if a parent says to a child, here is this gun, you can hold on to it while you're enrolled in this class that lasts 12 months. Has that person committed an offense or not?
The purpose of the transfer is intended by the language is for the purposes of hunting, target practice, or other lawful purposes, and the use, the temporary transfer is for use during those lawful purposes, not intermittent periods of time afterwards, because you cannot currently do it. So, I mean, if you're going hunting one Saturday and then you're going hunting a month later, you can't keep the gun.
How about if you have a weekly hunter safety course that lasts a year?
Weekly?
Sure.
A gray area.
Okay. Okay, anything else on this part? Jack, you have any other questions? Okay. Section 4.
Section 4 deals with felons being barred from possession of firearms and other restricted weapons. The marijuana exemption was deleted as far as an exemption, and it explains how a felon can get relief from his disability.
Jack?
With the deletion of the marijuana exemption, the example that came to my mind is the person was convicted of possession of under an ounce in 1973 before it was reduced and was still a felony, and then was on probation for 5 years to 78, he still would be unable to possess a weapon until 1993 under this, with that deletion, correct?
That's included in the 15 years. It's not 15 years since that probation for
right.
That offense, correct.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Section 5 deals with mental health reporting. This has taken on many different looks throughout. It originally started out with therapists reporting people who they felt should not possess or purchase firearms. We ran into several problems with that. We ended up linking it to Senate Bill.
Can you talk a little louder, please?
Yes.
Thanks,
because
we don't have a doesn't.
No problem.
A bracket going on out there. I'm sorry.
This is now linked to Senate Bill 412, which deals with the duty to warn, and it's reports made by therapists to local law enforcement agencies. We're saying, this Section 5 says, when these reports are made, then these persons will go on a prohibited person list in the health division, and they will be notified of this.
Okay, what about anybody who doesn't get on that list? Is that the only persons we're talking about who are mentally ill? Could you tell us more about what else you have here?
As far as mentally ill being prohibited?
Yes.
There's also, that comes up in other the prohibited person categories, I think it's section...
Okay, so the section 5 only deals with the registry in 412, but we're going to get to more of the inclusions of mentally ill folks somewhere.
Correct.
In other sections. Is that it?
Madam Chair, it's also included on the prohibited persons list, page 10, starting on line 11. Persons committed to the mental health division, or actually line 3, persons who are found guilty except for insanity, who are under the supervision of the PSRB, persons committed to the mental health division, either before or after this act goes into effect, because the civil commitment statutes are proposed to be amended under this bill.
Okay,
so
where are the civil commitment statutes? They're in the next. We'll get to those.
We'll get to those.
Okay.
But the other persons who are mentally ill, the PSRB folks, and your civilly committed persons are on that list.
The health division is going to be the one that maintains that, right?
Correct.
Who has access to that?
Law enforcement. I think it would be on the LEDs as a plan to be in a law enforcement data system.
Okay. Okay. And that's obviously been checked out, and there's a capability there, and everybody's ready to go. That's part of why I went down to Ways and Means. Is that what we're talking about there?
It is part of why.
Okay.
Okay, Section 6 6. It deals with the reporting of information to LEDs, and we're including misdemeanor involving violence there for the purposes of law enforcement doing a background check. That will be flagged.
Okay, any misdemeanor involving violence, we've covered that somewhere along the line, right?
Definitions.
To know what that is?
Mm-hmm. We did.
Section 1.
Yeah, it's in Section 1.
Okay. Sorry, I was out of the room.
Well, it was discussed.
Okay,
whether we know what it is may be a different matter.
Okay.
Okay, Section 7. This repeals the current concealed weapon permit statutes and enacts Section 8, which includes a whole list of criteria much the same as far as you're not a prohibited person, and it also includes a 45-day background check, and there's a section on competency with the handgun. The idea behind this new language is so that law-abiding citizens will be issued concealed licenses to carry concealed weapons. Currently, the language is vague. It talks about a need, and many people find, like in Multnomah County, law-abiding citizens do not get such a permit.
Madam Chair.
Sir Shoemaker.
I noted that under Section 8 that the standard for being allowed to have a handgun, concealed handgun, is completion of, and then there's quite a range of different courses. Maybe somebody can tell me whether completion necessarily means competence. And I could see someone taking a course and doing very badly in it, not attending class, or when attending, not paying attention. But when the course is over, you've completed it. Does completion mean more than that?
Madam Chair, Senator Schumacher, John Nichols, Oregon State Rifle and Pistol Association. We lifted this criteria whole hog with some minor changes for Oregon phraseology out of the Florida law that was passed last year. Currently, there's no requirement that the permit holder know which end of a gun the bullet comes out of. Some sheriff's offices offer some training, others don't. We felt, if I may speak for the working group, and somebody else might prefer that at least with something like this, we could be reasonably assumed that the individual would know how to at least minimally handle a firearm.
Yeah.
There are not ranges. If we had an infinite number of shooting ranges or a shooting range in every city, we might have gone with some sort of mandatory hands-on experience. But we felt this was better than the alternative, which was nothing.
Okay, now if I understand the implication of your answer, at least, there are no standards then set for a certificate of completion. It's just that you take the course. We have to decide whether that's okay. If it's more than we have now, maybe it's fine.
Yeah, I would assume that's fairly correct.
Does anybody know anything different from that? Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else have any questions on this issue? Senator Springer.
Section 8. How's Bob Skipper feel about this? I haven't heard from him personally. I know that that's been a problem for my sheriff in the past, a big problem. Maybe he has changed his mind on this, but can you tell me? Or,
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, I have not had an opportunity to talk with him about this specifically, so I do not know how he feels about it. Perhaps John Nichols has.
Yes, we need Sheriff Brooks. We need to have you identify yourself.
I'm sorry, I'm Sheriff Brooks, Lane County.
Sorry to interrupt you, but.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, I spoke with Sheriff Skipper prior to the his election, and he stated to me at that time that he felt that the Multnomah County criteria was a trifle stringent under his predecessor, and that he would issue under the current law and after he got elected, he would like to sit down with various groups and develop criteria. I gave him a copy of this bill, and he did not specify any problems with it. Obviously, you could contact him directly, but I don't believe that he would have any problem with it.
Okay, I think I may want to do that. I'm sorry I haven't had a chance yet. But further clarification, not that I'm thinking about purchasing a handgun, but he talked down in lines 23 about presents evidence of equivalent experience with a handgun through participation in organized shooting competition or military service. What can you give me a little bit better feel for what equivalent experience through military service? I mean, I went through qualification firing on 45s, AK-47, 5-inch 54s. I mean, I was a gunnery officer. Does that mean I'm qualified under this?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, as I stated earlier, this was we lifted this from the Florida statute, and it was kind of figured it was better than anything we had now, that the individual could be reasonably expected to know which end of the gun the bullet came out of. And in the absence of
some sort
of... It's
a pretty high standard.
Pardon?
I said that's a pretty high standard.
And in the absence of training facilities to ensure that someone did, it's better than nothing.
I appreciate what you're saying. I'm just looking for a little further clarification. Thank you.
Oh.
Senator Shoemaker?
I'm looking over the application for license to carry a concealed handgun, which is part of Section 8, and I note that it tracks with most of the requirements of Section 8, but doesn't seem to require any statement of completion of any of those courses. And I'm wondering if that's an intentional deletion or an oversight or what.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shoemaker, Sheriff Burks again. I believe it was intended that during the process of issuing licenses that these type of questions would be asked, and there probably would be a checkoff slip that the issuing officer would fill out, and these questions would be asked. It could be included, certainly. It was not, but it could be asked.
The other things apparently are to get the applicant on record as having saying under, I guess it says it under oath, not under oath, but at least making a signed statement that certain things are true, and it would seem that appropriate that that would include a statement about whatever demonstration of competence that person has to receive the license.
Madam Chair, Representative Shoemaker, I believe that a supplemental form, as we currently use in our office, would probably be the answer to this unless the form application was changed.
So if we're going to make amendments anyway, I mean, if we're going to do this, that's the only reason to change. If we are to make some changes, and I think we must because of the violation problem. This is another one that I take it no one would have any difficulty with. Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Let's move to section 9, I guess, right? Is that where we are with this,
yeah.
Story?
Section 9.
So we've got a valid time period for 2 years.
Right.
Right?
Right.
What else is haven't we covered in there on what we deal with?
It lays out what it looks like and a change. Now it doesn't have an identification of the firearm. Currently, when you do a license, it's for the specific firearm. So.
Okay, so it is for a specific firearm, not just any old handgun, whatever one you happen to have at the moment.
It's current law is for a specific firearm. The changes are just for a handgun.
Okay,
in
so
general.
You could, under the change, have whatever one you chose to carry at the present time.
Correct.
Senator Springer.
Let me ask, this may be here, but I think one of the concerns in the past, there may have been some question as to if, say, the sheriff in Kay Falls had issued concealed weapon permit, whether or not a person traveled outside of that county, just whether or not they might have some liability. Is that addressed here? I assume it is. And let me also ask, is there some provision so that when a person does have such a license, that that would be registered on the appropriate LED system so that, say, jurisdictions would know that, in fact, this individual had a valid permit even though it were issued in another county? Say this person lives in the valley, they're going to go east of the mountains, and they want to carry a handgun with them as part of their hunting trip, which is happens pretty often, I guess. Was there any discussion of computerizing these records also? In addition, you know, the guy leaves the thing in the car, leaves the card at home. How are you going to check out and see whether or not, is there a way to try to back that up with a computer system?
One, it does state that if you do not carry, if you don't have a license on you, that that's evidence that you don't have a license. So you will need to have it with you at all times. And if you are ever, so if you don't have it, you're assumed that you're not licensed. And if you do anything that would prevent you from getting a license, that license will be revoked then at that time. So in the second part of the question, no, there is not. There was discussion about it, but it didn't pursue the avenue of a central listing of who was licensed or not.
So it's prima facie, you know, you've got to have your
pass. You're probably going to get arrested for unlawful possession. Or, and I'm just trying to think if there's a, if there had been some discussion, apparently there was some, but that idea at this point was not
adopted. Senator Chair, Senator Springer, it's my recollection that we did discuss it. I don't know that we ever reached a conclusion. LEDs is in the process of changing their whole program, as I understand it, and it certainly could be incorporated, and I believe that it should. We had a similar discussion about the registration of the mentally incompetent and how that would best be done, and LEDs was mentioned. And I don't know that that ever was finalized. There is a recent court case which clearly establishes under current case law that a concealed weapon is, permit is good throughout the state of Oregon.
It is, okay.
That's my understanding.
I think maybe Jack has a question.
I can't give the sites, but there is one.
Does this bill clarify that, or is there a need maybe to restate that in this bill? If that is the latest court decision, or?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, there was a lot of discussion about this issue on the House side, and certainly the intent, I think the way it was read, that because there were uniform criteria, that that permits would be valid throughout the state. If the committee wanted to make that more clear, I suppose it is doable, but certainly the intent of establishing a uniform set of procedures and criteria was in part to set up the expectation that they would be valid statewide.
I appreciate that, and I think that's good policy, and I don't know if, I think one of the signals was we're not going to amend this bill, but are there?
No, we are going to, okay. Well, we are going to amend at least a couple pieces.
There's a few things okay. That need to be fixed.
Okay.
So it's not as if we're talking about major, you know, I think that's.
You know, I just think that if you can state, if the section of the law where people are going to be looking at it, just put it there, and so it's just, there's no doubt that, in fact, that's the case, and maybe independent of this bill, we can take the next step that the sheriff has suggested, putting these things on LEDs, because I think that would be to everyone's benefit, the person who forgot their license and is going to get arrested otherwise, and to others who may want to check the validity. I suppose these things could be canceled for some reason, yet the person would still have the card with them. There's no way that, if it is subject to revocation, and I assume it is, if a person later is found to do something, is that part of this too?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, yes and no. There is, part of this bill contains an interim study that's going to look at having better uniform driver's licenses and other sorts of things. It would seem to me that that issue, because these are issued generally by DMV, could be incorporated, that issue that you're raising probably could be incorporated into the interim study, because the issue is really the same.
Okay. Yeah. Just last question, is there any specific provision that does speak to cancellation or suspension if the person later is found to have violated or acted contrary to any of the conditions?
Yes. Madam Chair, okay. Senator Springer, John Nichols again. Yes, any condition that would prohibit the individual from getting a permit would automatically require its revocation, and any police officer who apprehends that individual is authorized to pick up the license if he determines through a records check that the person is prohibited.
Thank you.
And one more question from Jack.
Since Senator Springer brought it up, I had planned on waiting until we got to the a little bit later. In response to Senator Springer's question, Corey said that there's, I think, a presumption that if a person doesn't have a license on them, that they don't have one. I understand that a person can be arrested. Let's assume a person has a valid license but doesn't have it on them. I understand that a person can be arrested. Can they be convicted? And the reason I bring that up is because there are two driving without a driver's license statutes that have caused a lot of confusion, and it involves the same question of whether the crime is intended to cover the person who has a valid license and just doesn't have them on it.
I believe we discussed this in our working group, and I would defer to law enforcement, but that it's kind of, they refer to a driver's license situation where someone is picked up or, you know, it's ticketed without a driver's license, but the assumption then was that they go to court and they produce their concealed weapons license. But
so they don't have it to carry it with them, then they can just go to court and prove it. I think that's, does that contradict what you said earlier, which is if they don't have their license with them, you're presuming that they don't have it? Cover as much as we can.
So, for your representative, Senator. This is for your representative.
No, it's for us to. There's some other issues that we're concerned about, too, that would have to go on.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hill.
Well, Madam Chair, this is the area here where it's I believe, a class A misdemeanor to, for certain individuals to possess a firearm. And again, without belaboring it, we're down here again to this section I, where the within the previous 4 years has been diverted or convicted and twice convicted of crimes having an element of use of alcohol. It just seems really unfair that someone, if you're going to not allow them to have a gun, if it's prohibited to sell a gun to this individual is one thing, but if they already happen to have a firearm and they come under this, it just, I don't think that there's any logical way that someone would know that they would be subject to a Class A misdemeanor for possessing a firearm.
Senator Hill, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, one thing, it is annoyingly is used in there. A person commits a crime of unlawful possession of a firearm if the person knowingly, and that could also relate to the concealed weapon license situation where a person forgets to have it with them. I think knowingly would come into play, but it needs to be an almost, I don't want to say intentional, but it's a knowingly criteria.
Madam Chairman, Senator Hill, Sheriff Burks, there was a great deal of discussion about the alcohol issue, and it generally did center around driving under the influence, and it was felt strongly by the House Judiciary Committee, at least, that that was a very, very serious offense. And the guns and alcohol don't mix, and particularly with driving, to get two convictions, even one of which might be a diversion, is a very serious matter. You don't do that lightly unless you have very poor judgment.
So we're measuring people on the issue then is judgment, and one of the ways we're deciding whether people are qualified to bear arms is somebody's measure of judgment, I guess. And
that may be my own words, Madam Chairman. I wouldn't speak for the committee on that, but police officers run into guns and alcohol and drugs, and they don't mix, and driving doesn't mix. And
there's some evidence to indicate that, well.
I guess the thing is that, see, the premise behind this seems to be that because someone is arrested for drunk driving, that somehow that they are too dangerous to possess weapons. I mean, that's what this seems to at least imply, and it's not just a handgun, someone carrying it around. You're talking about a firearm of any kind, a rifle or a shotgun in somebody's home. I presume that these people, as long as they weren't driving, these people could still go hunting and go out in the, or wherever, and get a hunting license and everything. I guess maybe I'm just bothered by the whole idea of correlating drunk driving, meaning that somebody is a danger to, I mean, that they, and then make it a crime on top of that. I mean, if I were diverted or whatever, it would never occur to me that because I have a shotgun or a rifle in my home that I am going to be subject to a Class A misdemeanor. And in answer to your question, people are presumed to know the law. I mean, usually the law makes enough sense that people, it has some logical connection. And if you're talking about people, we were talking about abusing before, people who are chronically drunk or chronically, or if they're drug addicts or whatever, and their behavior is impaired, I don't have a problem with that. But when it just says that somebody in a 4-year period of time has been diverted or convicted, that somehow that translates them into being too irresponsible to possess a firearm, I guess I just don't see the correlation.
We've got to go to the floor. Dean, you want to take one quick, and while we're rustling around to get up here, the senators have been called for a call. We need it on the floor.
You can take 30 seconds, Madam Chair.
Introduce yourself. Yep. Great.
And I think what you just described was the logic behind the committee House Judiciary, was we tried to get at the chronic abuser, and although it really isn't clearly demonstrated here, we felt that two convictions within a 4-year period of time are major indicators that this person has an alcohol problem and is a chronic problem. And we tried to narrow it down into time period along with a number of offenses. Although it may not be readily apparent in this bill, that was the intent.
Okay, well, we've got to look at the drafting with respect to that kind of intent, then, I think. And we do need to go to the floor. We're in recess. We'll try to give people notice to indicate that we can get back here, and we'll all come back hopefully tonight. Maybe if we have a quick floor session, we'll come back after.
Well, just because of 5:23, since we're recessing this anyway, could I request that we
Take up 5.3 first. But we will be in recess, and we may be in recess until after the floor session, which may be 5 or 6 o'clock. Okay, where were we? Section...
She's thinking of you though, buddy. Let me tell you.
Yes.
That's what I understand.
Okay.
This is interrupting my dinner time dramatically.
Right. Section 12, we got through with, or did we?
Yes, we did.
Okay, section 13. That's where we sort of were, owning and possession and keeping it within the person's place. And we're sort of in the middle of crimes with having an element of each, the use of alcohol, twice. Within 4 years. I'm not sure whether he did or not. Well, I would expect him to.
I have got a technical question.
Okay.
Start off with. As I'm reading the list of people who commit the crime of unlawful possession of a firearm, it includes the laundry list of people that are included in, remember, the section 2 or 3?
2.
But it doesn't provide in there except as relieved under section 11. And I wonder if it shouldn't do that.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, it's referenced in Section 11, but it's not referenced in Section
or whatever 13. The appeal section is.
Right. So you probably need a cross-reference.
Yeah, we need to make clear that even if you do fall into one of these categories, if you made an appeal and it's been granted exemption, that it is now lawful for you to carry a firearm. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't appear in Section 13, if I read it correctly.
Jack, you understand what he's saying?
Yes, I do.
Okay, we need to flag that. Holly?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the issues that has been raised in this section has to do with the issue of constructive possession. It was not something that our committee dealt with. To be quite honest, it wasn't even raised, but I think this is a very legitimate legal question, which is if you have a gun in the house and you have one, you know, a spouse is a prohibited person and the other spouse is not, but the gun remains in the home, is that considered constructive possession for the purposes of this act? It is a legitimate question. Our committee did not deal with it. And it's something that your committee is going to have to address.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sure you understand the issue.
Yes, we've had it noted. Is that, I guess, well, we'd have to figure out where it probably does fit in this area, I suppose.
Because, Madam Chair, because this is the section that really deals with, as you start with really the or on line 10 and go down, that it's because of really those things that puts you into that, and that's all new law. If you look at old law, this is the old carrying concealed weapons prohibition, and then they added all this new stuff in terms of possession, which makes it somewhat more difficult. I think a provision could be added at the end of the section that addresses directly how you want to resolve the issue of constructive possession, but it wasn't raised with us, and we, to be quite frank, didn't deal with it. It probably also, well, I shouldn't say that, it probably also needs to be addressed in the issue on line 7 in terms of a vehicle.
Yeah. And the person's control or direction is probably not enough.
Jack.
I guess I would just comment that it probably, well, it's not for me to decide whether it's a good idea or not. My own personal opinion is it probably is to address that. If we do, I would suspect that there's no logical reason to not make the same changes in the ex-felon in possession statutes, for instance. I just mentioned that to point out that it's a bigger issue than just dealing with this section right here.
We're on Section 13, we've got into the question of constructive possession.
If you're a felon,
whether the wife is
or other member of the household.
Mm-hmm. And what do we do about it? And it is something that we have to address.
Let me suggest that maybe a way to get at that would be to prohibit it, except as permitted under the appeal section. So
I certainly am not interested in having everybody who runs down to the expense of an appeal, but that's just we're into a real work session.
That would be one way to deal with it anyway. If you could show that it's not going to be accessible by the person you're worried about, then you ought to be allowed to.
We didn't want to deal with all the tough issues. Save a few.
Right. Thanks.
I don't know how that didn't come up. I thought it was a very legitimate question. It was first raised to me on the floor of the House during the floor debate, and I was sort of surprised it hadn't been raised earlier, to be quite honest. So, and it's a very good issue.
Why don't you comment, please, John? Please.
Madam Chairman, John Nichols. I believe we discussed this in the working group, and I believe there's a body of case law related to, on the federal level, related to the Gun Control Act 1968, where originally, if someone was convicted, the federal government would go in and say nobody in the household could have a gun, and that was thrown out in federal court, and they said it was just specifically the prohibited individual, and they couldn't deprive a spouse or child or parent or whatever. But I don't have any citations, obviously, because this just came up.
Yeah.
That doesn't address the issue, though. If you have, for instance, a husband and a wife living in the same home who are both under firearms disabilities, there's still the issue of who has possession and what possession means. And whether only one of them or both of them is going to be subject to the criminal penalties.
Any other?
Let's move on.
Okay.
We'll return to that.
Okay, we're waiting for Representative Mannix, I think, to deal with that one.
Yeah. I'm sure I'll have a few amendments to the
right. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, 13. Firearms open and available, but not concealed. Jack, you have any questions? Anything else there?
No, not I'm sure. No.
Okay, section 13.
I have a question. I'm sure it can be answered, but why are not semi-automatic weapons included within the...
So moved.
Madam Chair, yeah. Senator Schumacher.
Shoemaker,
yeah, pardon me. 13A speaks to certain firearms that are regulated under Title II of the U.S. Code. They're registered with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Individuals are required to pay a $200 transfer tax on them. Semi-automatic firearms are regulated at the federal level under Title I, and there's no taxing and no registration requirement. The reason we put this in was because of sawed-off shotguns particularly are used in crimes, and currently the U.S. attorney in Oregon will not indict on a sawed-off shotgun case because possession of a sawed-off shotgun is not illegal under state law. This will give the locals, Chief Riley particularly was interested in having being able to indict a criminal with a sawed-off shotgun if the federal government would not do it.
Okay, would it make any sense to, since this is our law and we're trying to find a way to enforce our law about weapons that are particularly prone to be used in crimes, and I'm no expert on this, but semi-automatics are such weapons, aren't they? And they fire every time you pull the trigger.
Senator Shoemaker, this specifically speaks, this section, I mean, if it was the decision of the panel to put semi-autos under some place, it wouldn't be under here because you're talking about two different, it's impossible to register a semi-automatic with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms because it's a Title I gun as opposed to a Title II gun. It just isn't feasible under this particular section of federal law. And since we put as registered as required under federal law.
Thirteen A sub 2 says unlawful possession.
Well,
and enumerates those items, those guns which are registered with the federal government.
So that would be unlawful possession if you don't have them registered as required under federal law.
Senator, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Maddox, we're just starting, I guess, according to your comments in the paper, we're starting the horse trading right now on this bill. We just felt the effect of your horse trading on 1073 on the Senate floor tonight, and we'll understand that we're probably serving notice to you right now about horse trading.
Well, depends on what horses we want to trade, whether or not we have some ponies or some Appaloosas in the stable, Madam Chair.
So, we're ready.
The question of semi-automatics is a policy decision that has to be addressed. I'm Kevin Mannix, State Representative, District 32. The problem that we confronted is that
it's very hard to come up with a distinction between, we read in the press about the assault rifle or the military-style assault rifle. Actually, military-style assault rifles, the true military assault rifles are designed to be fired in bursts. You pull the trigger and you can have a selective fire, three-shot burst, or a longer burst than that. There are guns sold on the private market as opposed to the government market that look like assault rifles, but are actually just like any other semi-automatic rifle. That is just like a hunting rifle. That is, every time you pull the trigger, a separate shot is fired, and there's an automatic feed of the next round into the chamber. The difficulty was in trying to come up with some sort of distinction, and what we chose to do was just use the distinction that the federal government has used in terms of machine guns, short-barreled shotguns, silencers, short-barreled rifles, as opposed to rifles generally, which would include semi-automatic rifles, or as opposed to handguns. And of course, handguns can be single-shot revolvers, double-action revolvers. When I said single-shot, I meant single-action. So you could have a handgun that's semi-automatic. Every time you pull the trigger, another round is fed into the chamber. We chose to focus on handguns for special treatment, and then we chose to focus on machine guns and short-barreled shotguns and the like for special treatment. But in that gray area in between of which kinds of rifles are which, we chose to just stay out of that. Now, if you get to the point where you pull the trigger and more than one shot is fired, then it's going to be a Class B felony unless you've got it registered with the federal government. That's where we tried to draw the line.
Okay, well, our semi-automatic rifles, there are what we call attack rifles, which seem to be prone to misuse, I guess, to a much greater extent than 30-06s, Enfields, and a typical hunting rifle, which we're trying to protect from getting caught in this web. But these attack rifles are a scourge right now, and I'm sure that many of those are what we would call semi-automatic. If we were to not treat semi-automatics in that category, we would see them popping up as semi-automatics. And I'm just wondering if it isn't perhaps a better policy to include semi-automatic weapons in the category of weapons that we give special treatment to try to keep them out of hands of thugs.
Yes, Sam Hill.
I don't know what percentage of weapons are semi-automatic weapons, but there are an awful lot of them. I mean, semi-automatic are just ones that you pull the trigger. Every time it fires, you have to pull the trigger. It's just numerous. I'm sorry?
60%.
I mean, they make up, they're the predominance of the gun. So the automatic, of course, is a machine gun.
Yeah.
But I think to try to regulate all of them, I know that the assault rifle was used, and I think the thing that brought all of this, at least brought all of this to a head, but most weapons are semi-automatic.
Madam Chair, I mean, it's kind of following up along those lines. I think California has somehow managed to make the cut without disenfranchising 60% of the long gun owners. My sense is that the definition may turn in part, and John, feel free to correct me here, because I'm sure you're much better informed what other states are looking at, but I understand part of what some states look at in dealing, quote, with the assault rifle question is the size of the magazine, for example, whether you're going to have a drum or 20 or 30 round clip attached to it. I understand some of these versions, the conversion from semi to fully automatic requires an IQ of about 10 and a file to take it down. Or they sell conversion kits, in Cracker Jack boxes that'll convert these things, and that's the basic problem. Now, I've overstated this, but can you help us out a little bit there?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, the federal criteria for being readily convertible to a machine gun is it can be done in a fully equipped machine shop in 8 hours. That's case law, and I think it fits in the government book of the regulatory code. The working group talked a lot about semi-autos and whatever, and we just couldn't come up with a definition. They have in California, but it really doesn't...
How did California handle that?
They listed specific guns by type and manufacturer. They've got a laundry list of about 50 specific firearms that they say cannot be sold, in, or new guns cannot be sold in California, and existing guns have to be registered.
It's a sensitive policy, as you understand it.
We should start by taking a look at what they did do in California and see if there's some... Maybe they do a distinction that is a workable one. Although, being from California, I don't really believe we should rely on
that. That wouldn't sell it in itself, but it's worth looking at.
Worth looking at.
Madam Chair?
Do you have a California list just for inquiry's sake?
Madam Chairman, I don't have the list with me. I could get it, but I that which for the organizations that I'm not an employee of the National Rifle Association. I'm not an employee of the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms are also on the bill. I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon State Rifle and Pistol Association. And if the subject of semi-autos, what comes up in this thing, I think that's the breaking point as far as we're concerned.
Appreciate knowing that.
What we're interested in is the study in the back. If it shows in our year-long study that this type of firearm is a problem, we'll be the first to come in and ask for a regulation of them. I won't say there hasn't been any crimes in Oregon with the so-called semi-automatic assault rifles, but if it's minimal to at best. Portland, for example, last year, in spite of the hype, did not have a single crime with a so-called assault rifle. Washington, D.C., New York, Chicago, and San Francisco last year did not have crimes with semi-automatic assault rifles. And we would just as soon see what the study has to say before we do anything, because we would like the rest of the bill and not have it be the sinking point.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Maddox?
On that policy issue, one of the things that we tried to emphasize in terms of what we most wanted to regulate was a weapon which is concealable. And that's where the handgun regulation came in as a specific factor, because from all that we could see, from all the testimony we heard, handguns were the biggest problem. Handguns are most accessible, they are concealable, and they are the weapon of choice for criminals, not semi-automatic rifles. And when someone does get into using long guns, should they do so, interestingly enough, they get into sawed-off shotguns and devices like that, which are also explicitly prohibited here. The study, as Mr. Nichols pointed out, was intended to give us, though, some hard data that we can analyze after a year to get an idea of what kinds of sales are going on in the state, and then also from the statistics that we're going to be gathering on the criminal law enforcement side, what kind of a problem do we have on the crime front? And that was a compromise design to give us that handle without getting us into a situation where we might lose, frankly, a support from one of the...
I thought the mandatory 5 years firearms was supposed to be give the message on the crime front.
That was part of it, too. There's lots of messages in here, Senator Cohen. Although I'm also the one who said if you want to send a message, send a telegram. If you need to pass a law, pass a law.
Okay.
That's good.
Yeah. Further more questions? Section 15, I guess, is really where we are. So we have a crime of unlawfully attempting to purchase. Tell me what that means. Thank you.
Madam Chair, John
yes.
Nichols again on that. Currently, it's not a crime for an ex-con to walk into a gun store, currently an ex-convict is the only one that's prohibited from purchasing a handgun. But it's not a crime for a prohibited person to attempt to purchase a gun. Recently in Portland, we had a case where a couple of individuals walked into a gun shop, were rather flashy about the whole thing, and were attempting to buy a gun, and the gun dealer had his assistant go next door and phone the police, and the police ran the guy, and it turned out he'd been released from Oregon State Penitentiary the day before. The gun dealer said, well, I'll keep him here while you come and get him. And they said, sorry, that's not a crime. If you sell him the gun, we'll come and arrest him and arrest you because you sold one to a prohibited person. But we would like to have a do something about the straw sales where a prohibited person has a associate, a wife, girlfriend, or whatever, go buy a gun for him. We'd like to be able to get both of them. I believe that's one of the things law enforcement.
Oh, so it's more than so.
Yeah. Another section. As this is just specifically the individual himself trying to buy, but we also have elsewhere in the bill knowingly buying for a prohibited person. So I'm probably getting ahead of myself.
Jack. Oh, excuse me, Senator Springer.
Well, this is a question to counsel or to the proponents. Proving that somebody knew something is pretty tough to do beyond a reasonable doubt. Obviously, you have to rely upon circumstantial evidence or an admission. Is that basically the only way we can get at this in terms of the scienter that's required?
May I respond to that? We're fortunate in that, or unfortunate in that, in terms of filling out these forms, a person is going to be re-advised as to what the restrictions are on purchasing a firearm, and they're going to sign it. That they haven't been prohibited under all those prohibitions, and if someone signs that, they will have committed the act, and the knowledge portion will have been taken care of. Even on the long guns, for the time being, as part of the study, they'll have filled out that form, and it shows whether or not they're prohibited.
Thank you.
Jack?
Any further comment?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, also, when a person is released from the penitentiary, placed on temporary release, go through any one of those exit procedures, they are also advised that they cannot purchase a handgun. So at least for that population of persons that have been convicted of a crime, they are also advised that they cannot attempt to purchase a gun. So you pick up a group there as well.
Okay, and if
that comment was raised, though.
Yeah, if you had proved that at trial, is there any documentation that you had put in the person that did the screening and they say, I advise this person?
Yeah, there are forms that have to be signed by the person prior to release that has that information in them.
Yeah. Jack?
Does this create somewhat of an anomaly in that if the person is successful?